Hello, everyone, and welcome to Teach Right, the podcast for first-time instructors, experienced instructors, and anyone else interested in the teaching of writing. I'm Daniel Anderson, and we're coming to you from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We have a special episode today in which first-time English 105 teachers at Carolina reflect on their first semester teaching. Today we have Kyle Cunningham, Cal Draper, Holly Thompson, Faith Rush, and Renee Marzuk. And I'm going to hand it over. They're going to be talking about affective labor, really interesting aspect of teaching, touching on relationships, boundaries, resources, really helpful conversation. So what should our listeners know?
Okay. Hi, friends. So we're going to start talking with affective labor and thinking a lot about how the emotional aspect really goes into what we do, not just like the lesson planning, not just figuring out the lessons, but the emotional aspect that goes into that. So I would love to know our opinions about what has been like our experiences or struggles with the affective labor thus far.
I am the mother to 19 students. I am. And that is a role that is not appropriate or should be expected for everyone, but we work with people. Students are taught from grade K through 12 to trust teachers and to talk to them. And I do think in this transitional period, they're coming to college, they're coming right out of high school, and there are only 19 of them. It is really important to me to be a kind of adult in the room who knows who they are, who they can talk to, who they feel comfortable with. So that early in the semester, I realized that actually performing that sort of emotional labor was quite important to me, and felt really essential to how I was going to teach the class.
I think for me, this has a lot of different dimensions, like thinking about when affective labor happens in the process of being a 105 instructor. But what stands out the most is I'm a chill guy. And sometimes when you're a teacher, you can't be chill. And that was hard for me to be like strict with my students. And I didn't succeed. My students all have good grades and they might not all deserve good grades. But it's something that I've had to work through. And I think why the affective labor conversation is so interesting to me is like that, it has nothing to do, like when I'm sitting there thinking about like, how do I be more strict and still feel like myself, because that's what needs to happen, but I'm not comfortable with that. And working myself into being comfortable with that, finding strategies for, I guess, coping with being an asshole sometimes, which I still haven't figured out like how to navigate, but I'm working on it. That work happens like when I'm like staying up at night. It doesn't happen when I'm like sitting there grading, or it does happen also when I'm sitting there grading, but it doesn't happen in the kind of codified way that I think other types of labor that are involved with 105 do happen. And so when I think about like affective labor, it's been those like moments of excess that happen outside of the purview of what we normally would associate with the labor of teaching. And then it also happens in the moment when you're like in there and you're like, oh, I have to do my claps and get the class to listen to me because they're on their phones right now. And that can't happen, but that's not a mode of interaction that I'm very comfortable with, because normally I don't care. Normally I'm just a chill guy. Yeah.
I think that's really interesting. And it makes me wonder what do we think of when we say affective labor? What exactly does it mean? And I like how you use the word excess to refer to it. I find that was true for me as well. Mostly at the beginning of the semester, I would just go to bed thinking about English 105. And I would dream with them. What are they doing in my dreams? And I'd be thinking all the time of what I could do to help them. And I think that's another important component, is the sense of responsibility that we have toward them. I think that becomes the base of that affective component that seeps into other aspects of our lives.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Renee. And something I think about too with affective labor is communicating it with other people, just where your emotions are throughout the semester. Because at some point you're going to hit a dip, and you're going to feel low. about your work and about your planning. And so I think having other teachers in the cohort that you could speak with and just see how, gauge their emotions and see where they are. And yeah, not vent, but share your experiences with teaching this class, I think can be helpful to add in that social component when you're dealing with effective labor.
I think something, Kyle, that you said and something that we're all touching on a little bit is like this idea of the teaching persona and like how we show up in the classroom and how that deals with like effective labor. And I find that I also struggle with that because, okay, you got to turn, it's like a switch, you turn it on. And then at some point to what you were saying, Renee, like you have to turn it off because if not, you'll just constantly be thinking about it. And that is when the excess like continues and that takes up a lot of your time and it can be very emotionally exhausting. So sometimes too, I think that plays into like imposter syndrome, right? Like when we're up there, we're teaching, we're like, I don't know, like I'm a first year, second year, this is like our first time teaching. Even if you've taught before, there's still that feeling of, do I actually know what I'm doing? Can they see like behind the facade? Is this like a Wizard of Oz moment where they look behind and they're like, oh my gosh, you're not what I thought. So it's like, how also do we deal with that? Like, how do we manage those feelings of imposter syndrome?
I have my students writing craft essays right now for their humanities unit, and I'm having them read their reflection journals, close read them, and analyze moments from the journals, syntax, grammar, affect, all kinds of things, whatever they're noticing. And so many of them have reported starting their journals with the intention to impress me. And I read that. I am simply impressed that you have shown up in this room. On day one, I was impressed that they did homework. But that was really eye-opening to me that regardless of whether or not we perceive ourselves as authority figures, they very much do. Mm-hmm. They very much do.
Yeah, I think I'm happy you brought up imposter syndrome, Faith. And that definitely is not in the script that we're looking at all. But I do think it's something that I definitely had struggled with because I had never really been in like a teaching role at all. And I have a lot of moments where I'm just like, I'm so dumb. Like and that's part of grad school. Part of being in a PhD program is constantly being put in positions where you feel like you're so dumb. And that's part of broader discussions about imposter syndrome. But it intersects with what you're saying, Holly, about like embodying this position of authority that you don't necessarily identify with, especially as a first-time instructor like me coming in to this program without any teaching experience, straight out of an undergrad setting. And like, I remember the first day of class just feeling so strange that there was like 19 faces looking at me as if I knew what I was saying. And I had a lesson plan, but that was it. And I was like, and pretty quickly, I just kept going. But I still, I feel like I'm just now coming into a place where I don't feel like a lack of confidence. And I am interested to hear from y'all, like, how has your own confidence as an instructor changed throughout the semester? Have you felt any of this imposter syndrome going on in relation to your, I don't know, validity as an instructor figure, as someone who possesses the expertise to impart onto these 19 freshmen sitting in your class? Because I've definitely struggled with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I can completely relate with what you're saying, Kyle, because I think it's almost like this, like your emotions and your sense of imposter syndrome is almost like a sine wave throughout the semester. I feel like for me, at least, it's, oh, I feel great today. And then the next class, it's, okay, that didn't go so well. So how can we fix this? But at the same time, I think something I'm trying to remind myself of being a first-year teacher like you are is reminding myself that there is no such thing as coming in and expecting that you will be this finished product, that teaching and learning the art of teaching and the craft of teaching takes time. Similar to writing an article for a journal, it's not going to be perfect the first time that you write it down, and there's a process to it, and I think that could take some time for us, but yeah, that's something I'm trying to figure out too.
I teach with the lights out, so I don't have to be perceived. Yeah. Straight up. Down.
I think part of it is also, as the semester goes by, you begin forming an idea of the students that are in front of you. At the beginning, everything is so abstract. There is so much uncertainty. But by now, I feel like I know them. I know their names. I've let them know me as well. So there is a relationship that feels real, in a way that leaves little room for the imposter syndrome concerns, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think student rapport is a really big aspect of teaching, at least for me, because I came from a background where I was an academic counselor, so I was dealing with like kids very one-on-one. So I'm very used to like, what's going on in your life? I want to know everything. And in this role, I have to take more of a step back. But I think there are really beautiful opportunities for you to establish that rapport with them and check in on them and see how they're doing. And I think that does alleviate the kind of fear that a lot of people have, like with the instructor professor persona, because it can be very intimidating, especially for other classes where they have 250 other students and there's one professor who's, I don't have time for this. I need to go do my research. So I think we as 105 teachers really are in a good position to be more personable with them. And I think that can alleviate some of that imposter syndrome that we feel when they do have that trust with us.
Yeah. I was going to say, to your point, Faith, I think some of my days where I felt better about teaching is when I show up early and I have one or two students who show up and we just have an off-the-cuff conversation. And just coming to know them a little bit better, I feel more comfortable teaching them and sharing that relationship. And yeah, like I have this one student who's in the marching band, and so he's at every football game. And so I ask him about that before every class, and we have a good conversation. And I think that translates into how he interacts in the classroom. And yeah, that helps some with my imposter syndrome for sure.
I was going to add to what you just said, Faith, is that I use the individual conference times for that as well. Mm-hmm. And that is maybe part of the effective labor. I require all students to meet with me at least once in the semester, and it's part of the participation grade. And we just come and talk. They give me their sense of how they're doing. I give them an informal assessment of how I think they're doing. And it's also a chance for them to ask questions they might not feel comfortable asking in a class setting. It's just creating that space. And it also humanizes them in a different way. I've been comparing, and it's so different, my experience of the same people in the class setting when compared to those individual conferences.
I think that rapport also facilitates transparency, which is very important to me as an instructor. I would like students to be able to trust me enough to say, I put this off until the last minute, or I was prioritizing other classes this week, or I wrote this at 3 a.m., because that then helps me teach them better. That helps me guide them into either different habits or into adaptations of those habits. Okay, this strategy might work in some contexts, and in other contexts, you might need to employ a different strategy. And so that's one of the reasons why rapport is really important to me, is that trust really helps you educate people better. It helps you understand who they are and what they're interested in and what they care about. And you can then actually teach them something quite meaningful and quite relevant to them.
Yeah, and I think that's something helpful to think about, is when you build those relationships, at what point do you lift the persona? And at what point do you keep the persona down and say, I'm in teaching mode right now and I'm the authority, versus I'm relating to you in another way? That's something that I think about a lot, and I'm not always sure how to do that. But
yeah, I think I'm thinking about how I build trust in the world with people, and then how the relationship of being an instructor and having students changes those dynamics. And I think like this is starting to make me think that like the specific kind of like anxiety over performance that is involved with embodying the authority of teaching for me is involved in like how that fractures the way that I build trust, like necessarily because of the like context that we're in, and how I'm not like quite comfortable with that yet. And I do think like creating space outside of the instructional setting in like your 50 or however long the 2-day-a-week sessions are, 50-minute sessions, is like crucial for that. I found that too. The conferences or coming to office hours or even just emailing with students can be really helpful for that. And I think that definitely has made me feel a little bit more comfortable, like going back to what you were saying, Renee, about like how it starts as this kind of abstract thing and then it's this set of real relationships that you have. But yeah, I do think I'm not quite sure how to navigate that, because it feels like it is always this different kind of relationship that can't exactly be the way that you would build trust with just peers or friends in the world. But it's trying to get close to that in a way that doesn't compromise like the instruction that needs to happen. So maybe imposter syndrome is just feeling uncomfortable with being existing in that different kind of like mode of relationality. I don't know. Maybe not.
I think you can bring that conversation into the classroom. I have, and I have them write copiously in their reflection journals constantly, and I leave comments on all of the entries. And the comments are largely asinine by design. And I worried in the beginning that maybe that was unprofessional of me, but they're informal in the way that I would talk to friends. And that very quickly facilitated space for them to become more informal. And then when they do that, they start writing more and they start telling you more things and they start proposing more ideas that they would otherwise feel uncertain about proposing. And in this process of us looking back at these reflection journals and them admitting that they're trying to profess or impress their instructor, I've just been very transparent with them in the classroom. And I've said, A, you don't need to impress me. I'm already impressed by you. B, it makes perfect sense that you're trying to impress me. You perceive me as an authority figure, and that's because I am. I'm the one standing at the front of the room, and I'm the one ultimately who will be evaluating your work at the end of the semester. So it makes sense that you are attuned to that relationship, but that doesn't mean that we can't approximate more of a peer-to-peer relationship if we both try and if we both believe in the value of that.
There's something that I'm thinking about as we are talking about effective labor, and we haven't touched upon this, is boundaries. It's fine that it will seep into our lives and that we'll care about the students, but should we set boundaries with them, with ourselves? I'm thinking about this creating of rapport. And how in real life, like you were saying before, Kyle, is usually based on disclosure. But disclosure is not something that can happen unchecked with students, between you and students, without jeopardizing the nature of the relationship, which is institutional. So I'm wondering, what do you all think about boundaries?
I think you have to have boundaries. I don't think there's a world in which you are teaching and that you wouldn't need them. I do think that's important. Like, you have to build the rapport, you have to establish that, and that's healthy and good. And at the same time, they're very, like, when you bring that wall down a bit, they can be very tempted to be like, oh, this means I can show up late and it doesn't matter. Or they think they can get away with more things than they normally would if you were like that strict authoritative figure. So I do think that there is a place to build the rapport, but at the same time, as long as there's respect there, they have to understand, okay, we've chatted, this was fun, this was great, but like when it's time to work, it's time to work. And I think that's something that I have struggled with a lot because I worked with students very one-on-one. Sometimes it's hard for me to rein that in. So I have to raise my voice and I tell them, I really hate having to yell at y'all. We're not in high school at this point. But sometimes you have to do that to rein it back in. And one of my students, he's my fault. And it's okay. But you have to understand, we are still in a classroom setting. We're not just like out here at the pit hanging out. So I think boundaries are important.
And what about boundaries with ourselves? And this maybe goes back to the issue of labor as a whole and then effective labor. Would it help to set boundaries on how much time we're going to dedicate to planning a class, for example? Ways of keeping ourselves also reined in.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe this is like the ADHD speaking, but I don't know how possible that is for me. Because that's what I set out to try and do. And I think that's part of why I conceptualize effective labor and sometimes just the labor of 105 outside of class as excess. Because I set out to do all right, I'll do a half an hour of lesson planning the day before I teach. And then, quickly I found out that if I let myself, I could be doing 3 hours of lesson planning. And even now, trying to be more vigilant about that, I will have moments where I'm like, oh, I want to redo this unit. Let me think about that. And I'm supposed to be reading and writing a seminar paper, maybe. But instead, I'm spending, 4 hours thinking about how I could change the day-by-day lessons and assignments and my slides. And I haven't found a successful strategy for curtailing that. kind of happen. I think boundaries are in like a necessity, but I don't know how to set them in stone. It feels to a certain extent like self boundaries need to be flexible, but they can't be too flexible. Otherwise, you do get stuck in whatever this thing is that just starts like a 4-hour rabbit hole onto my unit one yesterday for some reason. So I don't know, but I do feel like that is really important, but I don't have very effective strategies for not violating my own boundaries that I feel like I have. So I don't know. I don't know if any of y'all have more success in that area than I do.
Some anxiety came up in the podcast before us about having students do in-class work days. And for a variety of reasons, that's a very pedagogically sound thing to do. It's very beneficial to them. It gets them started. If they haven't, they're with their peers. They can talk to their peers. They can talk to you. So I really intentionally build in those days that are going to be extremely useful to the students. And I don't have to do a thing to prepare for them. And I build them in when I know the semester is going to be rough. I say, how much am I going to be suffering this week? How much work time do I want to give my students? And we have really productive time together where they're posing questions, they're talking to their peers, we do the Pomodoro method, it's great. So I think one strategy is to resist the temptation to always be delivering content, because giving them space to work or to collaborate is extremely valuable. I don't know if others have suggestions.
Yeah, I've definitely fallen into the temptation to give too much content. And I think that's where my boundaries begin to break down. Because like you said, Kyle, I can fall into these 3 to 4 hour rabbit holes. And there seems to be no end to that, yeah, that planning time. But I like what you said about building in these times for in class where they can work on their projects. And one thing that I do that has been helpful for me is making that a dual purpose class where I meet with the students while the others are working on their assignments. And I think one thing that does is it builds rapport, like we were saying earlier. It also lightens the load for me for that class day. And then I would even say thirdly, it gives me ideas of what I can talk about the next class. So if I see some gaps in student understanding, or if I see some things that students are struggling with, I can build a short activity out of that for the next class.
Yeah, I think for me, someone who's very like perfectionist, like type A, like it's hard for me to know when to stop. So I'm like, oh, I could do this all day. And I think too, that's also a reflection of the fact that we enjoy teaching. And I think that because we enjoy it, we want to put in like a lot of effort and time into it. But you do have to balance like your teaching persona and also your research like self, like that part of you that's still there, because we're doing both, right? Like we're not just doing one or the other. So I've definitely had a lot of moments where I'm like, oh my gosh, like I want to keep working on this. It's not where I want it to be. But I also know myself, and I know if I do this, like I could do this all night. So I have to cut myself off and be very firm with myself, even when it feels like uncomfortable or uneasy. And I think that helps. And also talking to my dad is great, because he's always just, okay, like you need, like it's time to stop. Like this is not fully what you're here to do. Like, you also came to get a degree and, like, you know, do the research that you're interested in, and making sure that I keep that a priority. So having community, which is what we talked about earlier too, always brings me back down to earth a little bit with that.
That's really great. And it also reminds me of the idea of community, of something that I had wanted to say before when we were talking about effective labor. And it's being aware of the university resources that are available for students. In many cases, there are resources in place that can help them in ways that we cannot. And just knowing what those are and just knowing how to direct students toward them just can take a huge load off of our shoulders. And we are at the same time helping and also being knowledgeable about the resources that are there for us, which they exist too, and they are not as used. Many of us have like community, family that we can turn to. But there is an infrastructure in place that we should know about, and we should be ready to share it with the students and to use it ourselves.
It takes a village to raise the 19 children in 105. It does. And it I sometimes feel unnecessarily guilty if I have to redirect a student to a resource that I know, in fact, is going to be more helpful to them than I will be. And my strategy with that is to be really mindful about how I redirect them and be really mindful about articulating that I'm interested and I care, but I'm not the most helpful person for you here. I'm not the person who can do the most for you. So I wonder if you guys have had to come up with strategies with how you like talk to students or redirect them to different resources through the course of this semester.
Yeah, I think like part of this for me, and I guess this ties into a lack of expertise in some areas, is that like I'm also learning these things. Like it's my first time as an instructor, and like I definitely last year as just a student was not looking at that part of the syllabus for myself. And so like I've had once or twice students like ask me about stuff like that, and I've had to just be like, I'll look into it with you. I don't know, but I'm definitely not the person for this. I can be the person who like helps you figure out who the person is. And that, I'm not sure if that's the best strategy, but that felt like the most honest thing to do, and also a more compassionate thing to do than just, oh, it's on the syllabus, like you got this, you can figure it out, and then sending, ask me any questions if you need, very disingenuously, because I don't have the answers to those questions. So yeah, that has been, for better or worse, my strategy is just disclosing that I don't know and working through it with them. I don't know. I would be interested to hear from y'all, going back to what Renee was saying, like, how have you navigated learning? That feels like not even effective. That's just extra labor to learn all of those university resources and to familiarize yourself with that infrastructure so that you can be like an expert in that, which is not really our subject area, but is kind of knowledge that we also need to be able to impart to students.
I think one practical thing you can do, excuse me, is have the resources saved on a document and have the link attached so that you can go into your little document and find it and distribute it instead of having to organically come up with the resources each time.
I think in my case it happens on a need basis. And again, I'm in the same boat first time. So I find, for example, this very particular student that has specific needs and that might benefit from the learning center. I identified that, and I just first went into the resources myself. So I could know how to frame it, how to direct this person to those resources. And it's a way of looking for help yourself. I remember at the beginning, and this goes back to the emotional labor thing. At the beginning, I was grading the first reading assignment for my class. And I had this work, and I couldn't understand what they were saying. And I just started crying because I was thinking, I'm putting in a position of trying to help this person and I don't even know if I can help them. So that was really stressful for me. And it just prompted, what can I do? First, I need to understand what's happening. But then the university has some resources that might be helpful for me. And yeah, it happened just because it was necessary. But now it's already on my belt. So if I were to find something similar, I don't think I would... it would be the same emotional turmoil.
Yeah, I think like something that and this ties into emotional labor a little bit as well, is understand, I am very aware that this is the rustiest I'm going to be as an instructor because it's my first time. But at the same time, like these students are taking 105 now with me. And I feel like one of the big things emotionally that I've had to negotiate is a guilt over myself not being as strong as I may be in future semesters after I've added more things to my tool belt, and an awareness that like it's still happening right now. And negotiating that is difficult, but it just has to happen. And so I don't know. I don't know if this is like a bleak one to end it off on. I know we're running close to time, but I guess I'll pass it off to all of y'all. Do you feel that kind of guilt as well? And what are your ways of negotiating it or resolving that kind of tension inside?
I used to be chewed up by it, and to some extent I still am, but there is no replacing the experience of looking at student work, not knowing how to help, and caring enough to cry about it. There's no replacing that kind of compassion and that deep investment. And I remind myself that there are many instructors in this world at the college level, at the K through 12 level, who do not care as much as I do or as the people at this table do. And I mean, it might be corny, but really believing in the value of the fact that you care deeply, I think is very important and very helpful to move past those feelings of being new and green, but to remind yourself that you are bringing something really valuable to your students regardless.